Well, I think for not only destinations, but really for all products, all categories, you know, the brand is the single most important asset you have. It's the most valuable asset a company has next to its employees. And how people perceive you, how they value you, is gold to companies and to destinations.
Welcome once again, everybody, to the Destination Marketing Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Stoker. We have a great show for you today and a guest that I've kind of teased you about on a few episodes in the past, and it's good to finally get him on. He and I have had some scheduling issues at different times, and we're finally able to make it work. Before we bring him on, just want to remind everybody of a couple things. First of all, if you have any questions or any suggestions, if you want to be a guest on the show, please email destinationmarketingpodcast@relicagency.com. We would love to get your feedback, suggestions, or like I said, have you on the show if you're interested. Also, remember reviews are very important to get us seen by more destinations. And if you feel like the content is valuable, please leave us a rating or a review. We would really appreciate that. And thanks to everybody that's already done so. But without further ado, our guest today is somebody that I've been aware of for a very long time. I've looked up to for a very long time and really excited to be able to have him on the show. It's Tom Love of Love Communications, an ad agency here in Salt Lake. And Tom, welcome to the show.
Well, Adam, it's a pleasure. Glad we could finally do this. You had a baby and I had the flu. So now we're on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And they just kind of staggered with each other. But yeah, we finally did it.
Happy to do it. I'm excited. I think you're doing a fabulous job with this show. So thank you for doing it.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. So we have a little something we do every show just to kind of break the ice and get the ball rolling. It's a destination marketing show. So we want to know, you know, what is your dream destination? If you could go anywhere in the world, Tom, where would it be?
That is a fabulous question. I think number one on my list would probably be Egypt. I have never been to Egypt. I'm sort of a historical nut. And to go back and to be able to witness firsthand living history really sort of gets me excited. So I love historical sites. And I would love to spend a month in Egypt.
Oh, you know, over time, you know, this is, I think, episode number 30 or so. And I ask this question every show, and it's been kind of a staple, and I get a different answer every time. And the problem is it puts another destination on my list of places I have to visit. Egypt is another one. You know, we haven't gotten that one yet, but you're right. The historical aspect of it, I mean, the pyramids and everything, it sounds amazing.
And what human beings were able to achieve. Yeah, we still don't understand how they built the pyramids, what technology was able to do it over 5,000 years ago. It was it was the smartest place in the world at the time. And we still don't really understand how humanity existed and built all of the things they did. And I've had two trips planned there that both got canceled primarily due to unrest and violence. So it's whet my appetite even more, especially to do like a cruise up the Nile and stop at Luxor and lots of cities in between. But I hope, you know, I hope it calms down enough for me to get there in my lifetime. That would be a dream spot.
So that's the main obstacle in your way right now is the danger of it. But if it calms down, you're there. Huh?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. And I'd go alone and hire a guide. I've had a lot of friends who do it. Just, you know, don't ever travel in a group of 40 or 50. And I hate that way to travel anyway. So I like to explore on my own in small groups of, you know, 2 to 6 with some friends. But hire a guide. I just think that's one of the smartest things you can do.
Yeah. Then you don't end up in a dark alley in the wrong place at the wrong time, right?
Right. And your time is wisely used and you see things that only locals know about. And I did that in Cuba a couple of years ago and we hired a guide for a week. And this is right before Obama went and opened it up. And it was a fabulous experience.
Oh, man. Yeah, that sounds great. So okay, I'm just going to go down that road. So tell me a couple of the things that you saw in Cuba that you thought were amazing.
The old town, which looks like you are either walking on a movie set or you are alive in 1953 and time came to a standstill. And you're walking up the main boulevard in the old town. And there are, you know, signs, 3D signs hanging over the streets, hanging over. It just looks like you're walking in 1953. It's dilapidated. It's run down. Some of the building storefronts have been repainted and redone. And, you know, and there are, you know, 1955 Chevys driving up and down the street. And it honestly feels like you have just gone back in time and it comes alive.
And for a history buff, that's a great experience, right?
Fabulous experience. And people were incredibly generous and friendly. You just can't, you know, what we learned there is you would sit down at dinner or, you know, at the bar at the end of the day and have a beer and start talking about politics. Because at the time, you know, President Obama was trying to open up Cuba and airlines were rushing to establish flights. And we had opened the embassy 6 months earlier and we were establishing relations. And it was really, everybody was sort of, you know, really excited. But if you talked about Cuban leadership or relationships with, you know, political relationships with the U.S., people would cower and shush you and go, you know, and then the phrase down there is they said, like, you know, Cuba has 1 million people and 6 million eyes. And everybody's watching. So you couldn't talk politics or relations or trade or anything like that out in public. It's really curious. I didn't even have that.
Wow.
I didn't even have that experience in China when we went on a trade mission to China. It was, you could talk sort of openly about it, but not in Cuba. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. A big mouth like me would struggle anytime there's something you can't talk about, you know?
Oh yeah. Boy, the locals would just cower and look around and go, what are you doing? Stop. No. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about Castro. No.
Probably makes you appreciate the freedom of speech a little bit more when you're in a place like that.
Of course it does. Yeah. Being willing to talk about anything without fear of retribution or reprisal. Of course.
Yeah. Well, interesting stuff. Tell me, is Cuba then the favorite place you've ever been, or is there other places that you've liked a little bit better?
No, one of the most fascinating experiences I've ever had was, and this is one of my favorite places, which is Ireland. And I've been to Ireland a few times. But this last trip, about 4 years ago, we ventured north and went and stayed in Belfast for 4 or 5 days. And that is one of the most fascinating cities I have ever been to on the planet.
Really?
Yeah. It's got a 3-mile-long peace wall with Catholics on one side and Protestants on the other. There's still tensions there today. There aren't shootings. There isn't the violence in Belfast today that there was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s with the Troubles. But boy, there sure is tensions. And to see these neighborhoods of, you know, orange Protestants that are loyal to the UK versus the Irish Catholics that are loyal to, you know, all of Ireland and want a united Ireland. It's so alive in this city, and it was going through a lot of struggles. It used to be the shipbuilding capital of the world, in the, you know, that's where the Titanic was built, and the Lusitania, and, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, it was the shipbuilding capital of the world. And then they lost it, and they lost sort of that business as we moved from ships to airlines and rails, but mostly to airlines, and their economy fell apart. So there's these real sort of middle class struggles to find a living and find an identity. But the battles between folks who identify as loyalists to the UK versus loyalists to a united Ireland and it's one of the prettiest cities. They have murals on every house and every building. The art installations in Belfast are overwhelming. It's the home to my favorite musician, Van Morrison. And we went to see Van live in Belfast. It was just, it's so alive and so vibrant. That's one of my favorite cities ever.
I can tell. It sounds amazing. And boy, you've got a unique talent. I can already tell of visiting places that fit in your wheelhouse. Something tells me before you plan a trip, there's a lot of research that goes into it.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You got to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to be, you know, you don't just show up and go, okay, you know, where are we? What are we doing today? No, I take a binder of, we've got tours. We've got tours on this day. We've got museums here. We visited the jail in Dublin where, you know, the Easter Rising happened in 1919 and the fight for independence for Ireland. And, you know, and there's always, you know, I plan out, you know, an activity, a visit, something every day, and then have some free time to sort of explore and feel the personality and the burn of a city and sort of what's happening, you know, always on foot. But then, you know, I had a guide and a black cab for all of Northern Ireland. We visited you know, the sets of Game of Thrones at the time that my son really wanted to see, and I wasn't watching the show at that point, but since have. And but boy, Belfast is a living museum of recent troubles, and it's this is the reason Brexit can't get done today. This is the one obstacle that is preventing the UK from leaving the European Union is discussing the Northern Ireland border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And they eliminated that hard border and those checks for customs and things. So it feels like a united Ireland. And we went back and forth between Ireland and Northern Ireland seamlessly. And Brexit has thrown that all into chaos, and no one can agree. You know, the European Union says, no, we're going to put that border back up. You're not part of the union anymore. We're going to have to put that border back up. And everyone in Ireland is freaking out about it because they don't want that. They don't want that border back. And that's the single most important argument that's preventing a successful Brexit exit.
Wow. Wow. Boy, I tell you what, I just learned more about Brexit than I have in all the news articles and everything that I've seen out there. So, man, I'm thinking, Tom, next year, I need you to plan a trip and I'm just going to tag along. I'm just going to follow you around and learn everything there is to know about the destination and the best things to do and the history. And it sounds amazing. Are you in?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what it's going to be. It's going to be far Eastern Europe, starting in Istanbul and then going to Budapest and then a 10-day cruise up the Danube River. Stopping in Vienna and then taking a train to Prague. It'll take about 3.5 weeks, but that's what's happening in May or September of 2020. That's the next trip on the agenda.
Okay. I'll check with the boss. You know, we got a baby that can't leave home, but I'll see if she'll let me go for 3.5 weeks.
Awesome.
If she's in, I'm in.
You're more than welcome.
Awesome. Well, Tom, I could tell you're passionate about travel and this is a show for destination marketers, and you know, you're the perfect guest to have on. And I want to have you tell everybody a little bit about your background and what you do. And then I'll kind of tell everybody how I've, you know, gotten to know who you are over the years and that our paths have crossed, and a little bit about the work you've done in the industry. So, let's start with kind of who you are and how you ended up as CEO of Love Communications.
Sure. Okay. Well, very happy to do that. I was, as a young person, I was in the, I interned at my father's agency, which was Harrison Love Advertising, when I was in high school and college. And that was sort of, he was a madman kind of guy. He was a 50s, 60s, 70s. He worked in the agency world in New York and then came back here to raise his family in early 1950s. And Harrison Love was sort of the premier firm in the Intermountain area, working with all the big brands, along with a couple of other, you know, Evans Advertising and Harrison Love and some of those great, great names and great people. And that was really the Mad Men era. So I was really exposed to advertising through my father's successful firm at that time. But I went into, after graduating from college, I went into media and worked on the media side and had a very successful career in television at both ABC4 and KUTV2 and worked there for about 15 years. And worked into the number two position at Channel 4 Television, general sales manager, you know, managing $44 million in sales. And there are three key jobs at a TV station. There's the general manager, the news director, and the sales director. And the news director is responsible for putting out the product, and the sales director is responsible for generating as much money for the station as possible. And it was a fun time. You know, it was a really fun time in the late 80s, 90s. It wasn't quite the pinnacle of the golden years of TV, you know, the 70s and the 80s, but it was a really, really fun time. And television stations made a lot of money in those days. And then we watched the advent of cable explode, and I went to become the director of the first cable internet company here in 1991 when CNN became world famous with the Iraqi war, the Gulf War, and watched that. And then in 1999, I was 39 years old. And I was looking, I had other agencies in Salt Lake that were my clients, and I didn't think a couple of them did the very best job. And I just thought, I can do better than these guys, and I don't want to work for somebody else anymore. I want to start my own firm. I talked two other people into doing it with me, an art director and a writer from Harrison Love, one of whom was my brother. I was the business guy. I would go out and pitch the business, and then these guys had produced the product. And we started and we started that 20 years ago, last August, and started with the three of us. And we made a profit in about the third month, and we've been making profits ever since. We work really hard. We're incredibly honest. We're transparent to our clientele. And now we're a 44-person, you know, $55 million in capitalized billings firm headquartered in Salt Lake City, but with clients, you know, sort of throughout the Intermountain West and media clients across the country. So it's been a very good run. We've been very fortunate and very lucky. We've had a lot of really great supportive clients. And we've carved out a really good niche in tourism in the last 10 years or so. So that's sort of the story of where we got here.
Great. Thank you for that. And I want to talk about how you carved out that niche in tourism. The way I was originally exposed to you is I started out in media myself. While I was still in school, actually, I worked at FM 100 and became familiar with Love Communications when I was selling radio at FM 100.
Uh-huh.
And that was in 2007 or 8. Gosh, I should know that off the top of my head. But so I was doing that first, and you guys were well-known and respected agency at that time. And then over the years, I remember when I was at Thomas Arts, I worked at Thomas Arts for a little while after school. And I remember you won, I believe it was Advertising Man of the Year in Utah. Is that right? Was that, what year was that?
There are two awards. There's the Ad Professional of the Year, which I won in 2001. And then there's the Silver Medal Award, which is a lifetime of achievement in advertising industry. And that's given more to senior people. Dave Thomas won it. He was a winner. I love Dave. I have all the respect in the world for Dave. He's been a friend for 40 years. So I won Ad Professional of the Year in early 2000s and then the Silver Medal in 2015. So
in 2015. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's more recent than I thought it was, but yeah, in 2015, I remember when you won that, and you mentioned Dave, you know, I owe a way too high of a percentage of the where I'm at in my career to the first year and a half of it that I had at Thomas Arts, where I really learned the ropes of advertising and got an opportunity. They hired me in 2009, when it probably the worst time in the history of advertising to graduate in advertising. And, you know, they gave me a $10 an hour internship there, and I was able to kind of break in and get to know the industry. And so, yeah, what a great business he's built, and a great mentor he's been to a lot of people.
Fabulous. Anyway, over the years, absolutely, no question about it. And I'm glad, one, that he paid his interns, because we totally believe in that. You always pay interns. I don't trust agencies that have interns work for free. No good. And Dave, you know how Dave got his start in the business?
Yeah, he was a junior high band teacher, right?
He wrote jingles. He played a guitar and would write jingles for clients, and that's how he got his start. And he's fabulous, and he's had multiple successful runs. So, but anyway, that's Dave.
Yeah, a little bit of a tangent, but common ground there for both of us. Yeah. But you know, several years ago, I actually heard you speak at I believe it was a breakout session of the Utah Tourism Conference, and you talked about branding. And you know, I've always had my opinions on branding, but it's always been difficult for me to articulate it. And you took all these different components of branding that were in my head, and you simplified it for me and made it really easy. And you said, and I'll never forget, you said, the simple definition of a brand is the sum of all the touch points the brand or organization has with the outside world. And really, when you boil it down to that, it's very simple. So tell me a little bit about, expand on that for me and for our listeners, about your philosophy on branding and why for destinations branding is so critical.
Okay. Well, I think for not only destinations, but really for all products, all categories, you know, the brand is the single most important asset you have. It's the most valuable asset a company has next to its employees. And how people perceive you, how they value you, is gold to companies and to destinations. It's what we seek to aspire. It's why we want to go there. It's how we want to visit. It's why we want to own that product. We're willing to go further, spend more, to get a brand that we want and desire. And so that's why it's important to build a brand. But yeah, a brand is the perception of value that consumers have in their mind. And that perception of value is all determined by every single touch point that a consumer can have with your brand. So if we're talking about, you know, like the state of Utah and the Utah Office of Tourism, there are millions of different possible touch points that folks can have. You know, at the top of that funnel, it's the perception of the state. It's two things. It's the messages that we pay to put out there, whether it's for skiing or it's for Southern Utah three season summer Red Rock marketing, because there are two main strategies we have for the state. It's, you know, summer in Southern Utah, or it's, you know, winter in skiing. Right. And so all the paid messages that we put out there, whether it's television, pre-roll, video, you know, banner ads, billboards, radio ad, interactive boards. We had a campaign 1 year in Los Angeles where we had nothing but digital billboards in LA that would give the weather forecasts, and that said, you know, your 24 inches of rain yesterday is our 2 feet of powder today. 19 flights leaving daily. So
that's great.
The first touch point is obviously, right, what are the messages? What are we doing? How are we inspiring people? The other touch points are sort of like the things that you can't control. News media, things that happen, our stance on public lands, the Bears Ears National Monument controversy, accidents or tragedies, or, you know, people who fall off Angel's Landing, or and then there's also good publicity too, like the 2002 Winter Olympics did a huge amount for the state of Utah that is really, really hard to measure in the eyes of the world. So there are all those, so the, you know, those two main strategies of touch points that you can pay and control, and then those touch points that you can't control and you're sort of at mercy to, and then everything in between. And I, you know, the other touch points are the ones when people come here, and you experience this when you go visit a place, and I experience when I go visit a place, or when folks come here, the thing that makes a destination magical are the people and how they treat you. And yep. I will totally stand by that on everything. The vistas can be beautiful. The food can be amazing. The adventure can be exhilarating, but if people are rude or unfriendly, nothing can overcome that. And if people are friendly and welcoming, everything else will be rosier and happier.
You know, Tom, I've talked about it too many times on this show, but my wife and I in 2015 went to Fiji, and the thing that made that, I mean, it rained the whole time, but the thing that made it our favorite trip ever was the relationships that we built with the people. You know, maybe I shouldn't go too deep on the story, but right. You know, we went deep sea fishing, right?
Right.
And one of the things that they did is you would catch the fish, and then they would take it, they'd cook it for you right there at the resort. And we went deep sea fishing with the people that worked at the resort. They were on the boat with us, and we caught two big fish. More meat than we could ever eat, right?
Right.
So on the way back, I asked the guy, I said, okay, well, am I allowed to give you the fish? And he said, well, no, we're not allowed to do that. And, you know, I ended up convincing him to take the fish, because it's like, I can't eat this fish.
Sure.
There's no reason for us to take it to the resort. You know, I paid for the deep sea fishing session. There's no reason they should be able to take the fish and use it. And so anyway, I talked him into it, and for the rest of the trip, all the, like, the whole staff immediately knew that we had done that. And so they, I can't remember the word that they kept calling me, but it was hilarious. And then they kept looking at me, and they'd hold up two fingers and say, one fish, one fish.
That's awesome.
And anyway, it was like this inside joke the whole rest of the trip. And, you know, the friendship that we built with those people, I mean, that's probably 60-70% of the experience, is just the feeling you have with the interactions you have within the destination, right?
Exactly right. And I think that's something that is one of the next evolutions in destination marketing. It's being able, and I talk about this with all of our clients in state and out of state, but I want locals to understand what the strategy, I want Moab locals to understand what the Moab strategy is. I want Zion National Park visitors to understand what the Zion Forever Project is. I want folks across the state of Utah. When we launched the Mighty Five campaign for the state of Utah in 2015, we weren't allowed by state statute to message to anybody in the state of Utah. So folks would be coming from outside the state and start talking about the Mighty Five, and people down in Bryce didn't know what it was. And so I think one of the first things that you really have to do is engage your local community, because they are the brand ambassadors of that community to the outside world.
Well, and your stakeholders control so many of the touch points that you would like to control, but really it's those one-to-one interactions, like you say. That stakeholder education is so critical. And I think you're absolutely right as far as it being the next step. More and more destinations have started to do a better job of educating their stakeholders. You know, for example, citizens don't understand in a lot of cases the tax implications of tourism and how much money it saves every individual family in the state.
Well, right? There's no question. It's almost $1,500 per family of a lighter tax burden that tourism brings to the state of Utah, $1.3 billion in tax revenue.
Wow.
My good friend Jim Winder, former Salt Lake County Sheriff here, who went down to become the Moab Chief of Police and cleaned things up there for 2 years, used to say, I want to put on the side, a thermometer on the side of every police car and fill it up to 81% and say, this is the percentage of your police force paid for by visitors' taxes. Because residents don't know that. They don't know the whole bit. And so it's incumbent upon us as destination marketers to educate and inform to local citizens. And I really think that's an important next wave of destination marketing, is making sure those touch points, those people that are on the ground, the shop owners, the restaurant owners, folks who work in the hotel, people you sit next to at a restaurant, locals, guides, who all have a deeper, better appreciation for what tourism and destination marketing does for their community. Because in the absence of that, they tend to think, you know, tourism has a huge negative impact and all of you go home, and nobody has the proper understanding of a reduction in tourism marketing how it would harm their community.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm glad you bring that up, and I hope our listeners are paying attention on this one. Of, you know, there's I don't want to call it a myth, but there's this comment about over tourism, right? And it's because the farther we get from that economic downturn that we had that caused such a dip in tourism, right?
Yeah.
The farther we get from it, the less people remember how much we needed it back then, right?
So absolutely.
The answer is not necessarily less tourism in a lot of these cases, which a lot of the citizens believe. It's actually, how do we provide different experiences and educate? I think a perfect example is Zion National Park and Arches National Park. I think those are two of the, in Utah,
correct,
two of the more controversial over tourism places here.
Correct.
But I feel like in those areas, instead of, hey, don't come, it's, hey, when you're here, here's the 10 other amazing places that you're not going to be shoulder to shoulder when you're here, right? Like Zion National Park is millions of acres, maybe not million, maybe it's thousands of acres of land, but only about 6% of it is where you're shoulder to shoulder, and the rest of it is wide open, right? So how do we educate people that are coming to the destination on the cool places to go and stop complaining about the over tourism, which I think is closer to a myth than not, because it's really a diverting traffic issue, right?
Totally agree. Zion National Park is 167,000 acres. It has,
there you go.
It had 4.7 million visitors this year. Yellowstone is like 200,000 square miles and has 4.3 million visitors. So, so we're jamming. We're the fourth busiest national park in the country through a single canyon, right? That's the pressure on Zion. In Arches, Kate Cannon, the Arches park superintendent, 2 weeks ago in Moab said, and I quote, "We don't have too many visitors to Arches. We have too many visitors to Arches between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. So our problem isn't exactly as you said, Adam. Our problem isn't that we have too many visitors. The problem is we have too many visitors all at the same time. So getting people to understand, and this is an initiative we're working on with our client in Moab, which is we're communicating now to people who have booked a trip but haven't come yet, to tell them, heads up, here's how to do Moab like a local. Get to the park before 9, go to the park at 4, or by the way, here are the 10 other areas outside the park boundaries that are almost equally stunning that will give you a fabulous experience. So
great.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Awesome.
Yeah. And so this explanation of over-tourism to locals is one real strategy, and then communicating the other greater parts. And Zion National Park is hard at work right now on an East Zion entrance. They made a the Park Service made a presentation on this. It's a $12 million new visitor center on the east side over on the Kanab side near Highway 89. That's going to be this like 3,000 acre bison pasture, visitor center, educational, interactive stuff, and open up 6,000 other acres to bike riding, hiking, trail biking, you know, off-road vehicles, et cetera, that allow you to have a Zion's experience without necessarily going inside the park. So you're exactly right. You're getting people to other greater areas is you know, our next big opportunity.
Great. That's great advice. And Tom, I actually have made a mistake and didn't ask you to tell us who some of your major tourism clients are, so people can kind of have it as a frame of reference. I know you mentioned Moab. I know you work with the state of Utah.
Yeah.
Who else are you guys working with on the tourism side?
Visit Salt Lake was our real first client in the tourism space, and that led to the opportunities with Utah Office of Tourism. But we worked with Scott Beck, who just recently left, with Visit Salt Lake, and marketing the four ski resorts in the canyons as Ski City USA, and then the Convention and Visitors Bureau at the rest of the year. Visit Salt Lake Snowbird's a client. Kanab is a client, a fabulous client. Kane County and the town of Kanab, they happen to have one of the most expensive resort hotels in the world in
Amangiri.
Amangiri, yes, exactly right. Yeah. So this is where the Brad Pitts of the world go to hide from people and spend $1,800 a night. And so it kicks off a couple $1 million a year in TRT. The county, you know, as you know, has to spend on marketing and promotion of the county. So Kanab is a fabulous town. They have 5 million people go through Highway 89 on that town to visit, you know, the Grand Canyon or Zion or Bryce. It's the slot canyoneering capital of the world. I mean, it's so fun to go in some of our rural Utah towns and hear the languages and meet people from all over the globe who, the treasures we have in Southern Utah are just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Totally agree. Well, yeah, it's fun to really see the impact of tourism on some of those small communities. Like you said, you know, we work with several other destinations here in Utah.
I know you do. Yeah, you do a great job. Yes,
thank you. Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible to see, you know, what they're able to do. In some cases, you know, you've got all this traffic coming in and a very small population, and what they're able to accomplish is just really fun in the tourism space. And I think a lot of our listeners, you know, worldwide, we've got a couple of listeners in New Zealand that reached out to us over the last few weeks. And I think the things that we learn here in Utah with some of these communities that you serve and that we serve, these principles apply to any destination, right? Just a Utah situation. There's misconceptions of over-tourism in probably every state of the union, depending on the attraction,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And understanding that this is an education thing, and that all of the different touch points that a destination has with the outside world are critical to manage. Like if you're doing a great job with your advertising campaign, but all your hotel employees in the county are mean to everybody that comes.
Right, absolutely right.
It's not enough, no. Right? So let's talk.
It kills.
Let's talk
it.
Evaluation.
But I want to say kia ora to our friends in New Zealand, because I spent 2.5 weeks in New Zealand 2 years ago and went from Auckland at the top down to Queenstown at the bottom.
And of course you did.
It is absolutely boy. Those guys do tourism right. I mean, these are two islands of 4 million people. 1.7 of them are in Auckland. And then the rest of the country is just, and we drove the whole thing or boat and on lakes. And, you know, there are no spiders in New Zealand. There are no snakes in New Zealand. They have done such a job of good stewardship of protecting the natural resources, especially on the southern island of New Zealand. The rest of the world and lots of America could learn from what they do. It's spectacular. They have the purest Clearwater Lake in Queenstown. It looks like, and they talk about it when you're there, that man only discovered it in 1860, and it looks like that today.
They oh, wow.
preserved it. It looks like you are the first human being to ever see this lake. It is crystal clear. It's 99.9% pure. It's just jaw-dropping in its beauty. And so anyway, my hat's off to your listeners in New Zealand, because it's a fabulous experience.
Yeah, you know, New Zealand has been on my bucket list now for, at the very top of my bucket list now for years, and you only make it sound more appealing. And definitely a high priority for me to make my way out there. It sounds like an amazing
place. And when you go, make sure you go to a town called Christchurch that suffered from severe earthquakes about 7 years ago, if you'll remember that. It's happened to them twice.
Yeah.
They really got, and then they had Christchurch also had the mosque shooting last year. But Christchurch was a city in rubbles. I mean, Adam, you go to it, and the main part of town, it's still in rubbles, and it's just bricks laying in a pile and a half of church still sitting there.
Oh, wow.
It's not like America where they go in and they'll, you know, plow down a couple of blocks and new structures come up immediately. Each individual entity is responsible for rebuilding themselves, and they take their time. But what did pop up in Christchurch that was so amazing was art, human art installations and displays, and they had a display called White Chairs. They have 181 white chairs sitting in a park that represent every person who died in that earthquake. And it's just
wow.
takes your breath away. And Christchurch, they haven't rebuilt all of Christchurch, but the first thing they did was build art, beautiful, beautiful interactive art displays all over. It was one of the most, I'd put that as one of my top five cities in the country or the world that I've ever
seen. Okay. Christchurch. It's on the list.
There you go.
Absolutely. Thank you, man. Tom, I got bad news for you. You're going to get a lot of emails from me when I'm considering places to travel.
Yeah, happy. Awesome. Great. That's
great. Hey, let's switch gears a little bit.
Sure.
Let's talk about evaluating your touch points, right? If I'm a destination, now let's get tactical.
Okay.
I'm a destination. I know I've got all these touch points. Where do I start in evaluating and prioritizing what to solve for first?
What a great question. I think you do the block and tackling. You make a list and you live it like a visitor. And you go through and you do that. And from the point of entry, whether it's via the airport or via the road or via some other mode of transportation, what do visitors see? How do they experience? What are their first exposures? Where do they go? How do they do it? What's the reception? How do they get to the hotel? What are the roads like? What's the traffic like? Are Ubers available? How do we handle transportation? What's the reception? How are the people at those touch points? And then what do you do when you get out on the trail or the road or the museum or the street? And literally, I think you make a list of all of those touch points and you incorporate all of these people into, you know, your planning and your communication, whether it's the restaurant owners or the hoteliers or guides, if you're an outdoor rec spot, or, you know, association of museums. You know, you think about what your touch points would be in Salt Lake City versus a Moab, and they're completely different. But I think you have to go do it. And it reminds me of a lesson I learned early on from Earl Holding, Little America and Sinclair, who was known to be the most detail-oriented owner. Folks had a hard time working for him because he was so focused on, he would inspect rooms and go check the length of the curtains.
Oh, wow.
He was such a detail guy. And he used to say, you know what, in our business, you got to serve hot food hot and cold food cold. And it's amazing how many people screw it up.
It's the basics.
It's the basics. It's the blocking and tackling. And if you can have an impact on that experience of how people are treated when they're in your care, that's what you do when you're a destination marketing organization and you get everybody on your team. And living the brand. You know, what's the brand of Kanab? It's magically unspoiled. And what's the brand of Salt Lake versus the brand of Ogden? Ogden has a fabulous marketing strategy of notoriously
yes.
independent. They use the word notorious. Now, this is it's kind of curious for a destination marketing organization. Say, we're notorious. We're a little rebel. We're a little, you know, we're a little out there. We are a notoriously Western. We're notoriously adventurous. We're notoriously in interest, you know, and it's part of their brand. Well, you want everybody who lives, works, and plays in Ogden to sort of understand that. It's,
right.
You know, it's okay to be a little notorious. It's okay to be a little out there. It's okay to be a little Western. And the most successful firms, companies, DMOs that do that have a clear brand that they can communicate to the outside world and to their inside world. And the more that locals can live that brand, because they're brand ambassadors, the better off you're
going to be. You know, one of the things I love that you said there, Tom, is if you're a destination marketer, I think one of the cliche things that people say is, well, put yourself in the shoes of the visitor, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, I can sit here and think, what would it be like to be the visitor? No, arrive at the airport.
Go do it.
Right? Do exactly what a visitor would do. Take the Uber, go to the hotel, stay at the hotel. Don't tell anyone who you are.
Right.
Experience it exactly as a visitor would. And I tell you, Tom, I totally agree with you that you will know very quickly which touch points are a problem.
Exactly.
Right?
Oh,
once
yeah.
you experience it as a visitor.
Yeah, absolutely. You probably suspect it, but you got to go live it and you got to go do it. Yeah. And your staff. Yeah. Secret shop, your own community. No question.
Absolutely. Tom, I tell you, obviously, I was really excited to have you on today, and I think I could sit here and I could talk to you for hours about marketing and destination marketing specifically, but I think some of our listeners have gotten used to our 30 to 40 minute episodes.
No question.
So I do want to ask you, though, especially since you've been in the industry for a long time, you obviously know what you're doing with advertising and marketing. I'd love to have you just share if there's anything we haven't asked you that you feel like destination marketers need to know. I'd love to have you share that with our listeners.
Boy, that's what destination marketers need to know. I'd say be true to your brand. Really understand who you are and embrace it and own it. Don't ever try to be something. This is not aspirational branding. This is be true to yourself and this
authenticity, right?
And don't be afraid of it. Don't be embarrassed by it. Don't be, you know. And I'm going to point to Ogden and Kanab as two examples. Kanab, they used to say, "Well, we don't have any hotels. We don't have places to stay. We don't have a convention center. We don't have, you know, we're not Moab. We don't have all these signs. We don't have all these facilities." I said, great, that's a feature, not a problem. Kanab is magically unspoiled, and it's the only experience in the authentic American West where it's still unspoiled. So come now while you can, before 7 billion other people do. And so that's the strategy. We just took what they considered was a problem. And went, are you kidding me? You are sitting on a gold mine. This is... You know, take what's true and embrace it and turn it on its head. And that's exactly what Ogden has done by becoming notoriously independent. They love to say in Ogden, they're rich at the right time and poor at the right time. And they were a railroad town built from the 1880s to the 1930s, and they were really rich and flush. And they had nine railroads coming into Ogden at one point in town. And we think of it now as sort of a railroad town and a little bit run down, and they suffered, but they were really rich between 1880 and 1930. Then we stopped traveling by train and we started traveling by airline. And so all of the train business went away and downtown fell into total disrepair. And in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they were too poor to demolish everything and rebuild. So it's all preserved now and refurbished. So they have this amazing historic downtown that they, you know, thankfully never destroyed. Any other town, if they'd been able to do it, would have torn it all down and rebuilt it. And then they would have had no character. So what do? They take that old West character and they run with it and embrace it. And so that's what any DMO does. You know, what might look as our problem or our failure might really be our strength.
Yeah, be true to who you are and lean into what makes you unique, right?
Very, very well said.
Well, Tom, this has been wonderful. And for me, especially having you know, watched you as a mentor from a distance over the years, I really appreciate the opportunity to have you on the show, chat with you here for a while. And I think the wealth of knowledge that you've shared with our listeners has been extremely beneficial. One of my favorite episodes so far. So thank you so much.
Well, Adam, you're too kind, and I admire what you do and how you built your agency. And thank you for doing this podcast. And it's my pleasure and my honor. And I thank you.
Great. Well, everybody, this has been another episode of the Destination Marketing Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Reminder, leave us a review. Also, join the Destination Marketers LinkedIn group where we are posting many things from the show, but also we've got a lot of other people in the channel that are posting tips, tricks, experiences, case studies, and it's really getting fun in there. So if you haven't joined, go in, request, we'll approve you and get you in there. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody.